Hi, everyone, and welcome to Empowering Homeschool Conversations. My name is Peggy Floyer. I'm the founder and CEO of Sped Homeschool, as well as the host of this broadcast, Empowering Homeschool Conversations, that is put on by the Ministry of Sped Homeschool. We are just excited that you are with us today. I know we're a half an hour early than our normal live broadcast time. And so just thank you for popping on early to join us. And this month, we're focusing on the topic of early education preschool, which we know a lot of you have questions about. And we're super excited to be addressing this very early stage of homeschooling, which is now becoming more and more popular every year, especially in this special education disability segment of the homeschooling population. For a long time, a lot of our parents were really encouraged, use the early education programs, use the public schools. They're the experts. And we're realizing over and over again, especially since the pandemic, that the people that call themselves experts aren't always the experts. It's you, the parents, who have been with your child since they've been born. And we're here to encourage you in that and encourage you if you felt called to homeschool, even a struggling learner, a child with a diagnosable disability or any type of struggle, that you can homeschool preschool too. And so we're just excited that you're here with us this hour. And Julia Nally is with us, back with us today. Julia, thank you again for popping on to our broadcast and being willing to share with us on this topic. I'm so excited to have you share just from your wealth of experience. I know that you're a veteran of 35 years of plus years of homeschooling, and you just have so much practical advice and wisdom and down to earth knowledge that you have to share. And so I'm excited to hear all the things that you have to share with our audience today. So welcome.
Thank you. So my name is Julia Nall, but the the first name is actually pronounced Julie, because my parents named me Julia and they decided to call me Julie. That was one of those bloopers. But anyway, and then Nall's rhymes with small and tall. My husband's tall, I'm small. So anyway, I have five kids, two by O, and both of those are moved on out of the house. One of them just got married this past year.
Oh, congrats.
And I have three kids who are adopted, and all three are from Ukraine, which is very near and dear to our hearts.
Yeah.
We're like soaked into Ukraine news every day, all day. Have lots of friends over there, pray a lot for Ukraine. Yes. So I have a nursing license, which is like, I'm a little pretend nurse from years ago. I don't do much nursing. I have an education degree, and I have a master's of arts with counseling, Old Testament and pastoral ministries.
Wow, that's a great
And
mix.
I have taught for 35 to 40 plus years. And then my husband and I also own and co-write BiblioPlan, which is a history literature curriculum for kindergarten through 12th. So I kind of have all of that.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited for you to talk about pre-K, and we're going to kind of cover pre-K through second grade. And so what makes you so passionate? Because I know when we've scheduled this broadcast like last year, and because you said that this was something you were super passionate about. So where does that passion come from?
For a lot of reasons. One, because nobody was talking about it. Like if you go to homeschool conventions, there's not a lot of people that were addressing what do you do with the littles. And so, and right. I love littles. The seven and under is my love. I love that. It's when my degree was in, when I was an education major. I love their joy. I love their honesty. I love how gullible they are. You can get them to believe anything. Yesterday I was speaking at a school, and after I finished speaking, my husband and I were kind of quietly leaving, and this little 5-year-old came flying down the hall all by herself, wrapped her arms around me, and said, thank you. And I was just I just was so cool. I just love them. They are so cute. They love mystery. They love silly. They love stories. They love pretend. I remember being a little. So, and in a lot of ways, I feel like that's my qualification for talking about littles, is because I was a little once. I remember what it was like. I remember playing toy soldiers and dressing up with my sister and turning my dollhouse into a hospital. I remember learning to read. And I remember the stress of learning to read because we were in a very high-functioning, high-stressful school that really pushed it. And I remember being stressed over reading. I remember learning how to swim. I remember swinging on the swings. I, as I said, I have five kids, so I have kind of gone through the little stage with all five of them, even though my adopted kids are older. When we got them, they still went through the little stage. Every adopted child comes in emotionally a baby. And so we did it with them. I've taught littles over and over again. It's probably the age of choice. Whenever I'm given a choice of what you want to teach, I'll go for the littles. And my husband and I have also written curriculum. So with our curriculum from K to 12, we have a whole part of it that is for the littles.
So, that's awesome. Cause starting out, and I think the one thing that really resonated with me that you talked about was that stress, and that understanding that stress, even as a young child, when teaching and learning becomes something that is pushed, versus in the child feeling that. I don't think we often think about that, but that is a really good point that you made, that is transferable if we have that anxiety or that that agenda that is maybe beyond just the working with the child. And too often that's the public school and the private school, they have that set agenda because they're on a timeline. And that makes it difficult, especially for those strugglers. Before we go on to the next question, I do want to remind our viewers, if you're joining us live, just know that you can make comments. You can put questions in the feed, whether you're watching on YouTube or Facebook. We want you to be part of this conversation. So definitely put those there, and we'll be happy to interact with you. We're going to save the questions for the end, and then we'll address those when we get to the end of this conversation. But we're super happy that you're with us. And yes, those are great qualifications, Julie. And I just it's so exciting to glean from your knowledge. I'm sure there's been some mishaps probably along the way.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have flubbed parenting many times. I actually apologize to my oldest a lot. I'm so sorry for all the things that I put you through. Yeah. So this talk is not coming from a perspective of I'm an expert. It's coming from a perspective of I have learned some things in life as a 60-year-old looking back.
That is a great perspective, because I think oftentimes we look at these conversations and we're like, oh my goodness, or I have these conversations with people like you, and I'll go in the back of my mind and go, well, I just really messed up my kids even more than I knew I had. But we don't want to approach it like that. We learn as God allows us to learn, and he has a lot of grace with us, and we need to have grace with ourselves. And so thank you for, just compiling what you learned over the years and being willing to share it with us, because that's what's most important. Starting out that conversation, I mean, we learn things, we gain wisdom, but what is probably the greatest thing that you want parents to know and to understand about this early education process?
I'm going to start out. Yeah. The most important piece of advice I wish that someone had shared with me when I was starting out, when my kids were kindergarten. I mean, when my kids were in 2, 3, 4 year old and I was getting ready to go into the whole teaching process, I wish someone had told me, Julie, let them be little.
Oh, yes.
Let them be little. Yeah. Everything that for my rest of whatever I talk about today, that everything that I say hinges on those four words. Their time to be little is so fleeting. They grow up so fast in your excitement, moms, as you're out there homeschooling and you got these littles and you want to get started and you're just gearing for it and you're so excited. Don't push them over the grow up cliff. Mm. Let them be their precious little, funny, hyperactive selves. I miss my littles. I miss that age. And I wish I would have cherished that more than I did.
Yeah. Yeah. That is so, so true. I mean, because so many times we're told push, push, push.
Yep.
And so I love that countercultural advice, definitely, because, we just need to keep saying it more and more.
Let them be little. Mm-hmm. So our firstborns is the ones where we start that whole thing. So we love them. They're like our pride and joy, those firstborns. And if you're watching this and you have kids, you have a firstborn. They're the ones that have paved the way to this thing called parenting. They're the ones who taught us how to get so excited about first steps, first words, first rolling over for all the firsts. Yeah. They're the ones that have the biggest books, the biggest keepsakes. But we are also the hardest on them.
Yeah.
We are the hardest. The road they pave, those firstborns, is actually a hard road. We tend to want them to be the most behaved, the smartest, the cleverest, the top of the pyramid, because they are our reflection. How they do is kind of looks like, oh, especially when we're homeschooling, we're starting out in the homeschooling world, that firstborn, they have to look good because it'll make me look good. And if they look bad, then I'm going to look bad. So we tend to push them. It's hard to hold back when we have a lot of dreams for them. And I was personally everything times 10. I was so hard on my firstborn. I was so proud of him. I was so proud. And I just want everybody to know how smart he was. And I pushed him over the grow up cliff. Mm. And I'm ashamed to say that. I was that kind of a mom.
So was I.
Don't be like me. It hurt him. It was hard on him. I sucked the joy of learning out of him. I put performance over being a little person. Yeah. So, you know, let them be little.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Get off that comparison train that we get on where we are looking at, my friend's child is doing this and my child is not. That means my child has somehow failed. Don't do it. Don't compare. The others in your church, they're your kids. Don't worry about them. You've got yours. Yours, however God created that little person, that's who they are. Mm. And the other pitfall that I did was I compared them to me. Well, I was reading at this point, or I loved this at this point. Why isn't my child doing that? My husband was gifted in math. Why isn't my child in that doing that? You know, and so you kind of tend to place expectations, especially on that firstborn, of us, who we were, and they're not us. They are a combination of other things. Mm-hmm. And we just have to let up, ease up, quit. And so much of it is pride. It was for me. Oh, it was so much pride. Mm. And, you know, if I could take pride and I could just throw it out the window, it would be so much better off. Get off the grow up train. Let your kids be little. That grow up train, that comparison train forces them to grow up.
Yeah, it certainly does. But how do we make that change? I mean, it's so ingrained in us because all of us that haven't, you know, really been instructed on how to change that, we'll follow that same road. So do you have any advice on that?
Letting them be little. So last year I was at a convention and it was for struggling readers and I had a mom that was in the room, and most of the people that come to my talks are, you know, third, fourth, fifth grade kind of and up. They're, you know, they're not a lot of families with little. Some of them are, but most of them are not. Yeah. So that's kind of my assumption, is that I've got, you know, upper elementary kids and families in the room. So this lady raised her hand and she's concerned about her child because her child doesn't want to read, doesn't want to learn to read. Mm-hmm. And so I talked to her in the session, and after the session, she came up and she was just tears, just so upset, so worried. Mm-hmm. And I was giving her lots of advice because, you know, I was trying to help her and I was giving her so many ideas. And then as the course of the conversation goes on, I somehow asked her, I said, well, how old is your child?
Mm-hmm.
She was four. She was 4 years old. And mom was upset because the child didn't want to learn to read. And she was just, she was having a panic attack over her 4 year old. And mom, if your 4 year old doesn't want to learn to read, that is okay. If they're balking at letters, that is okay. They don't have to, they're too little. Let them be little. They are communicating to you by their behavior and that they're not ready.
They're not ready. Exactly. Not
ready.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to throw pride out, ease up, forget trying to compete, just yes.
Yeah.
The number one subject your littles need to study is play.
Oh, yes. So good. I agree.
Mm-hmm. That's the number one subject. If for this age, kindergarten, preschool, younger preschool, first kindergarten, first, second grade, the number one subject is play. And you go, well, second graders, yes, they need to play too. Mm-hmm. It's important for two-year-olds. It's important for three-year-olds, five-year-olds. It's important for six and seven. It's important for me. I love playing with my kids. I love playing.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. So play. I mean, we've talked about this on our broadcast before, but I really want you to focus on it for this, you know, broadcast, especially because we push it. And so can you really talk about that importance of play and enjoy playing with our children too? Because I think sometimes we've lost that art in our own lives. And coming back to around to grasping that.
Yep. Play is important for healthy brain development. It's the foundation of learning on so many levels. Yeah. Reading skills and math skills all are born out of play. Mm. Play helps children gain in areas of imagination and creativity. Without those, then children struggle to problem solve later in life. They're going to have struggles because if they haven't learned how to imagine or create or think outside the box, they're going to have trouble in reading and math. Yeah. Play teaches cooperation. It teaches sharing. It teaches peer learning. How do we get along with each other in life? It increases their language skills. Have you ever sat and listened to a little girl holding her baby doll in her arms and talking to it and practicing all of the language that mommy uses with them? They are redoing it with their babies. It's physically healthy. They need it. It gets them moving and grooving. We want our little people to sit quietly in their chairs with their feet planted on the floors, and they're not able. That's not their thing. Play lets them move and groove and get all that wiggle out and get all that giggle out and get all that action out. It teaches them spatial awareness. My little girl has epilepsy. And when she was in the orphanage, they made her sit on a couch. She had to, because they didn't want her falling and having seizures because she had seizures all the time. So they made her sit on the couch for the 3 years that she was there. She never was allowed off the couch. They kept her there because that kept her safe. And so she had a really hard time when she came out with the whole spatial awareness stuff because she had to learn all of it. She's really great now, but it took a while. Fine motor, gross motor skills, all of those were hampered because she didn't get to move and groove.
Right. So, we forget about those things, don't we?
Play is really important. It should be an integral part of your school day. So it's not an afterthought. It's not I'll just have not to play, but I'm going to do school. Play is school. And that's a hard concept for people, but play is school. And there's two types of play. There's unregulated play and there's regulated play.
Oh, can you talk about that?
So unregulated play is free time. It's just do nothing time. It's just go have fun, go out, run around. It's not electronic time. And it's not TV. Play is playing, and it's not telling them what to play. It just plays. It allows a child to be little. And remember, we are letting them be little. Unregulated play gives children the time to freelance, to think up pretend worlds, to create, to build, to just be. And that's unregulated play.
Yeah, and I just recently read too that there's been a new study out that said unregulated play actually has been proven to create new brain cells. And so we can actually build the brain through unregulated play and not just the neurodevelopmental, you know, pathways. So important. I'm so glad you touched on that. So the difference then, so we have unregulated play. What is regulated play then? What would that incorporate?
Regulated play teaches through play. So it's now it's more of a mom oriented or a, you know, it's a designed play. Every lesson for this age range, kindergarten through second grade, should include regulated play. Kids are doers. Kids want to do. They thrive on doing. My students, they come to my class, even if they're not in this age range, even if they're older, they want to do. They come to do. They don't come to fill out worksheets. They don't come to listen to dry lectures. They want to experience the lesson hands-on, active. Mm. Regulated play is how you teach reading, math, science, history. That's how you teach those things. It includes painting and coloring and drawing and Play-Doh and gluing and cutting. It means giving them tools to create, pulling stuff out and directing their play. You can hand them props and tell them to reenact a story.
Yeah.
You can pull out blocks and tell them to create a pyramid. You can give them paper towel rolls and paper and toilet paper rolls and tell them to build a marble maze. You can give them Play-Doh and tell them to form their letters. You can give them paint and tell them to illustrate a story. So you're giving them tools and you're designing their play around that. Regulated play makes learning fun. It makes it fun. Regulated play can be done all day, every day, driving in the car. Find the letter M. How many M's can we find as we're driving down the road? Counting the stairs as you climb, walking through the shopping center, reading the labels, finding things that, you know, as you're going through the shops, let's find all the red cans. Let's find all the blue cans, you know, things like that. Finding colors, whatever you have them do. On top of that, let them experiment. Let them get messy. So I've just given them all those paper towel rolls and we've made a marble raise. Now they can take those paper towel rolls and move into unregulated play where they can just do whatever they want to with it. And that's important.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Did that continue that education? That's kind of that exploratory moving beyond where you've taken it and then allowing them to use that learned knowledge to then build on it on their own. So you're incorporating that multi-sensory, you know, just the dynamics of hands-on and experimentation and just making it fun in general. Yep. Yeah.
So when I was in college, I was working on a piece of, when I was in college getting my education degree at elementary, I had to take an elementary art class. Mm. And it wasn't an art class for kids. It was an art class. It was an adult art class on how to teach elementary art to children. So we're learning how to teach art to kids. Okay. So the professor was this really short, little, cute, little eccentric lady. she had full of pep and she was just extremely artistic and creative. And her mantra to us was to provide tools for the kids to be creative, but don't tell them how to do it. Just give them an open-ended. So one day she came into class and she had this great big huge box of junk. It's one of those just rick-rack junk in the box. She had bottle caps and she had little everything you could think of. Everything that she'd collected over the years was a massive box. Scraps of this, scraps of that. If you're an art teacher, you're going to have a lot of it. Beads, jewels, treasures, toy parts, paper clips, anything. Okay. So she handed each of us a round piece of cardboard, scissors and glue, and said, now make a pizza.
Huh.
And we had to take whatever was in the box and we had to create a pizza out of it. And we were college students and we were, we all knew each other. We were all in the same classes together and we're sitting around a box of junk. And we start laughing and we start having the best time. It was probably one of the most memorable classes I ever had, individual classes. We had so much fun making our pizzas. And by the time we were done, everybody's pizza was uniquely different.
Yeah.
And I learned a really powerful lesson that day, because if she had given us an example, if she had shown us a pizza, I want you to make a pizza, and it held up a pizza for us to make.
Right.
We all probably would have emulated parts or a lot of what she did. Mm. But because she just said, make a pizza, we were free to create in a very open-ended way. I still have my pizza. I still have it in a file up in my education stuff, because it was just such a cool activity. So one of the other things that I learned was that from her was that if you have to make a sample, because sometimes you do have to show the children what to do. Hmm. If you have to make a sample, make a really bad one.
Oh,
make your sample really bad. Like, I do that when I teach in any class that I teach, my samples are always really pitiful. They are just kind of, this is kind of what I want it to look like, but not much. And moms and dads, when we create, when we try to show our kids, or when we're doing stuff with them and anything that we do, and what we create is perfect. Mm-hmm. And what it ends up doing, it ends up putting this pressure on your child to be perfect too. So right. if what I give them as a sample is perfect, then my children are going to, I've raised a bar that is too high for them to reach, especially our kindergarten, first, second graders who are struggling to cut paper and struggling to glue, and the globs of glue are on there, and they are never going to have what you've just created. Mm-hmm. And if yours is perfect, then they're going to feel bad in their little souls because they can't measure up. But if we have to show them an example, then we have to be like, just as like, mommy made this and it's not very good. So you do so, and you don't have to do yours like mine. That is my other mantra. You never have to copy me. You can do whatever you want. Just kind of, we're making this. You can kind of do it like that. And that frees them so much to just be creative.
Yeah, that's a really, really good advice. Cause we can pull in our pride, our own pride. I can do this well. So let me show my child what they can attain, you know, if they do really well. But it's not a competition. we're trying to nurture and develop them and to really highlight their unique talents and their ability to learn and grow. And I can't thank you enough for sharing about that, because we do. And it's so wise of your teacher to have given something that was recognizable to all of you, a pizza. And yet there is no one pizza that's ever the same. Mm-hmm. And so that made it the perfect example, because, you know, so maybe somebody has veggies, somebody has, you know, pepperoni, those pizzas in general are different. But they're all considered pizzas. So just to have that mentality as we're teaching things, that there's no one perfect example of anything, truthfully. The variety within a sphere of knowledge or an example is much more freeing, and the learning potential that you create from that is so much better.
Absolutely. So my one son spent 11 years in an orphanage, and they did crafts in the orphanage, but they were really mindless crafts. Every single one had to be exactly the same. So every coloring page had to be colored to the exact coloring pictures. He came, you know, so everything was, he lived with that for 11 years, and he was very, very OCD, very exacting. And they trained him to be that way. So he came home to me, who had a art teacher who was eccentric and who likes to think outside the box and tries to teach her kids how to think outside the box. And he really struggled. I would just give him a basic coloring picture, but I wouldn't tell him or show him what the picture was supposed to be like, you know, what the pictures were. And he would freak. He'd be like, but I don't know what color to color the shirt. I don't know how to color the pants, whatever color you want. But you have to show. No, I'm not. You just do whatever you want. It's okay. His situation was extreme, but we, in our desire to be perfect, we bind our kids. We frighten them. We tell them you have to stay inside the lines. And we reward them when they stay inside the lines, instead of, you know, easing up and it's okay if it goes outside the line. It's okay. And we tell them bananas are yellow, so they must be yellow on our paper. But when it comes to art, and art is the means for moving into a lot of other areas of learning. You're going from art into math, into reading, into all of these things. When it comes to art, we're teaching our kids to be creative. So hippos do not have to be gray. Tomatoes can be green. Elephants can have spots, and that's really hard for type A people. That's really hard for us because we want them to put everything in the box exactly like it's supposed to. And if the directions say put a check and your child puts an X, then we want to tell them, no, you're supposed to put a check. And they've put an X, and we, you know, they've thought outside the box. They've put it, you know, and we're just, it's really hard. It's really hard to let them be little. Right. Let them maybe not do it perfectly. Creativity is an essential tool for a child's healthy development. It's okay to get messy. It's okay to make art out of shaving cream. It's okay to deal with a mud puddle. It's okay to finger paint. And it's also okay to knock over the tower that you just built.
Oh, yes. Yes. That is so true. And yeah, we definitely need to hear that. So thank you so much. That's so good.
So play is a serious subject. It really is. It has many elements. You can see their little brains going into high gear when they play. As they play, they're developing an understanding of the world and how it works. Yes. For them, it's just being a child. But for us, it should be the number one subject for our littles. It should just be, it should be your number one subject, mom, dad. That's your number one subject. It's not overrated. Please don't discount it.
Yes. Yes. Thank you for, you know, really spending a good amount of time on this and starting this conversation with this, because it is so crucial. And the things that we see and the experts I've talked to, a lot of them say a lot of the issues we see cropping up with kids later on in their learning progress is because play was not highlighted enough. And those different developmental stages were skipped because play was skipped. And then we run into a whole plethora of problems afterwards because we didn't focus on this. And so, yeah, we have one of our viewers on Facebook said, "Ooh, has a child of the late 70s, 80s art instruction. I struggle with this too." So we understand. We're glad to be your tribe. You're not alone. So we get it. So if play is the number one subject, what's number two then?
Reading. Reading. It's important. It's the tool they're going to need to use for the rest of their lives. But I am going to say this, reading is too often our litmus test of intelligence.
Oh,
it was mine.
Yes.
I put way too much pressure on my kids. Each child, mom and dad, is going to blossom in reading at different times.
Yes.
Go slow. You are not on a speed train. Let your kids off the hook. If they read early, don't go crowing to your neighbors. Oh, my child is reading at age 4, because your child's friend who isn't reading yet is developing on a different train. Mm-hmm. And they're developing in areas where your child is probably not. The foundation of reading, though, is reading to your children. So especially for special needs kids, especially because a lot of families that are tuning in, keep reading to your kids. Read, 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 read. I have a little girl who's special needs. We read to her all the time. She's 11 and she's starting to read. And so much of the words that she's reading are words that we're reading to her all the time. Books, 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 easy books for those littles, the repetitive kind, rhyming,
easy Dr.
Seuss, nursery rhymes. I love the new series by Mo Willems with Elephant and Piggy. They are awesome books. My little makes us read those to her over and over and over again. Simple words, high frequency words. They memorize those books. Memorizing those books is a reading. It's a pre-reading skill.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
You're reading with joy. You're reading with expression. Mm-hmm. You're reading with gusto, and you're filling your child with the written word.
Oh, that's so good. I've never heard that before, but I remember being young and memorizing books and just how much joy it brought me, even though I didn't know what the words, you know, were exactly on the page. And so that just resonates with me so much. Can you say something about just that joy of reading with children? Because I think sometimes we forget that. We're just like, we should probably read.
No, reading should actually be a part of your school day. It should be like, in the same way that play is cemented in as part of your schedule, so should reading. Reading should be a cemented in part of your schedule. When I taught school, I read to my students every day. We had a cemented in reading time, and that was their favorite time, sitting on the floor and listening to me read stories to them. Don't think that your reading stops when your child starts reading. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. Reading books with your children should continue through elementary and into middle school and beyond, because you're helping them process so much as they're reading. They're processing language, they're processing vocabulary, they're processing ideas and concepts and morals and everything.
I did a lot of companion reading even in high school with my kids, and it kind of gave them that little bit to just kind of sit back and, in, like you said, process and learn, and allow my reading to just kind of help them with, especially those more difficult vocabulary words and those types of things. So completely agree. It just shouldn't stop. So what else do you have?
Okay, you're going to sing to them.
Again,
singing is like foundational for reading and math. It really is. If you're like, I got these kindergarten, first, second graders, part of your day should be music. It teaches rhythm. It teaches beat. It teaches cadence. It teaches vocabulary. Learning music, listening to songs, the kids are learning vocabulary. Children learn to memorize through music. So many lessons can be taught through music, especially at the littles age. You sing to your kids, listen to music, have it playing as you play, as you cook, as you ride in the car. Immerse your children in music. Nursery rhymes put to music. Rafi is awesome. So many good songs that Rafi does. Bible verses put to music.
Yes.
My children knew so much scripture because of music. All of my three kids that are special needs English as a second language, it's been music that has helped them to learn a lot of vocabulary that, you know, because they're listening to in the music all the time.
Yeah. Music is just so, it's so essential to the core of who we were created to be. I mean, we were made to have that melody and that rhythm. So yes, totally agree. And you can't walk away from something that you has caught in your mind. It just catches and you remember it. And so, that's so important.
So when you finally start formal reading, because you've read to them, you're singing music to them, they're learning lots and lots of pre-reading concepts in both of those things, plus with your play, reading should include three basics: learning to read, and that is the actual learning to read process, spelling, and handwriting. There's a lot of good programs. I don't recommend specific programs to people. I will talk privately to people, but not in public. But you want to find a program that encourages children through doing. Hands-on fun, music, active, engaging activities. Make sure the readers in the curriculum that your child is doing, that you've picked for them, are engaging. Yes. Nothing kills a child's love for reading more than boring readers, especially when they move past that point where they've actually started reading and they're continuing to read those boring readers. You're going to kill that
Camera.
You're going to blow it out.
I am a
phonics mama. I believe kids learn best through phonics. When I was in college, phonics was a bad word. We weren't even allowed to use it. I didn't drink that Kool-Aid. I absolutely have always believed that phonics is the way that kids learn the best. 40 years later, phonics is actually coming back in vogue in the public school system, which is just cracking me up. I taught first grade for a number of years, and here's what I learned when it came to reading. When the children came into my classroom, they were all over the place in terms of reading. Some didn't know their letters and sounds. Some knew their letters and sounds, but that was all they knew. Some were reading a little tiny bit, like simple, easy words. And they had a few each year who were reading on a third to fifth grade level. So I had like huge gap. But what I always found by the end of that year, because between the ages of 5 and 7, there's a huge thing that happens with the majority of kids. The vast majority of my students were reading on a middle, second grade and up level. And that's how most of my kids tested. And most of those kids were reading in the baby stage of reading. And what was even more interesting is that a chunk of kids every year had caught up with the early readers. So I usually had 3, 4, 5 kids that were now caught up with those kids that were reading on a third to fifth grade reading level.
Wow.
I did a combination of phonics, but I also taught the kids the high frequency words, because those are words that they're going to see in their books. Right. And I used the curriculum the school bought, but I also supplemented with lots and lots of learning centers and games.
Which goes back to what you were talking about earlier. It's that play that is so important. That's really cool. And encouraging too, at the same time.
So I knew a mom, she was a friend of mine. She had her children in a school where the school's philosophy was that you don't teach reading until third grade. Wow. And it was a really expensive school in our area. It's an elite school. And they paid a fortune for their child to go there for preschool, kindergarten, and first grade. And the school believed that play was the foundation for learning. So all their education was based around play, but they never did any formal teaching of reading or math during that time period. So her husband was a doctor, and he was really like concerned because his son was now finished with first grade and could not read a word in a book, and all his peers were reading, and he was really worried and nervous about his son because it was his oldest, mind you. And so he put his foot down and he said, he is not going back to this school. He is going to a school where they're going to teach my boy how to read. So they spent that summer trying to catch the child up, trying to catch them up because they were, he was behind. And I put that in quotes. He was behind.
I know. Yes.
So they worked really hard to do that. Well, when he went to second grade, he wasn't ready. He was not at the level of any of the other kids in the class. He was behind because they had, you know, all these years with a proper reading program, and this child had nothing, except play. Well, you fast forward to his graduation from high school, and he graduated number 3 in his class, and he went on to college. All that play he did from preschool, kindergarten, first grade, it didn't hurt him one bit. It would not have harmed him if he had stayed there in second grade and learned to read in third grade. He blossomed in reading later, and it was fine. And that's why, to me, play is my number one subject. I go back to
that. Yep.
Regulated play is the foundation for teaching reading.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've heard that from like older teachers who were instructed with certain elements of childhood, you know, just progression and play to know when to start teaching reading, because those were the crucial elements to have in place, not the sounds, not the recognition of the letters, but the actual movements and play of the child. And we have lost all that with these boxes of all the things that kids should know before reading should happen. And it's not about knowing, it's about that readiness, like you were talking about, and all of the things that we physically have to do. And it's physical. It's physical, and it's intellectual outside of that structured learning that creates that base that's so important.
So teaching reading, I made tons of activities, learning centers, games. I used to go to thrift shops. I found reading-based games. We did memory, bingo, Scrabble Junior, and the list goes on. We sang the phonics. Yeah. We sang it. We played rhyme games. We did. Mm-hmm. I did do worksheets with my own kids, and I did do worksheets at school, but it was not the primary reading means for how we learned. And the worksheets we did were fun and engaging.
Yeah. And I think that's encouraging to our parents too, because we often think, well, I got to have the best program. But maybe the best thing to choose is something you can find at a garage sale or that's already at your house for those types of things. And so, but you know, you said learning to read involves spelling and writing. So what about the spelling part?
So spelling and reading easily go hand in hand. They're pretty easy. Don't pick a spelling program that's separate from the reading program.
Really?
It makes sense for kids to learn to spell the words they're learning to read. And I'm a phonics-based reader. I'm a phonics-based speller. But they also need to learn those high-frequency words because they're going to use them a lot. So I tended to do both. Regulated play and spelling go hand in hand. Please don't just make your child write their spelling words and be done. That's like the most boring, awful, miserable existence.
It is.
Get shaving cream and have them write them in that. Kinetic sand, Play-Doh. I love the refrigerator magnets. We used to do that all the time. Children love whiteboards.
They love
the write on wipe off boards. Have them illustrate their spelling words. Okay, the word is cat. Oh. Let's draw cats and make it into a cat. Spelling can actually start later than reading, unless your child is ready to go. You don't have to start spelling right away. You can start, you know, in second grade, if they've started in reading in first grade or whatever, you can take your time with it. I didn't usually start doing spelling with my students until they were actually reading, till they had jumped into the actual reading department before we started doing spelling. Slow and steady wins the race. We're not on a grow up train. Spelling, they're going to get the words, you know, you're not, it's like, oh, I have to have this many words done in a certain amount of years, you know.
Right.
They're going to learn most of spelling by just writing.
Yeah. Yeah. I had the same mentality, and it really saved me a lot of frustration. So yeah, I completely agree. So what about handwriting?
So handwriting begins with early reading, writing their name, writing their letters. They're going to have to, as they're learning to read, they do need to write their letters. They need to do simple words. They need to do the block letters though. And I know that there's a huge push to skip the block letters and jump right to cursive in like kindergarten. That's not my train. The world is written in block.
No.
Block letters are written. Most of what the kids see at that age are block letters. And so to jump right into cursive is you're making it harder for them to read. They need to learn how to write the block letters, and then they can do cursive in second or third grade. I do think they do need cursive because the world is also written in cursive.
Especially around, historical documents.
Looking around the screen here, empowering homeschool conversations is a combination of cursive and block letters, and kids need to learn how to read that. Okay, but moms and dads, don't be fussed if your child at this age is writing their letters backwards. That's normal.
Yeah,
it is so normal for a kindergarten, first and second grade to put the B and the D and the P and the all of those letters backwards.
Right.
You don't need to like put red marks on them. You've just done this terrible. Just remind them that the B goes in this direction, the D goes in this direction. And also the other thing that we get so fussed over is they don't put their paper right. It's okay. If they've got their paper upside down and backwards and they're using it, you know, if you want to, if you're really ADHD about it or OCD about it, then put a little X. This is where the front of the paper is. But I had fourth graders who came to my creative writing class who still did it backwards and upside down.
Oh, wow.
Didn't get anything wrong. You know, it's just that it is what it is. Kids don't, it's not a concrete thing. It's more of an abstract thing, honestly, and knowing which way this paper is supposed to go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And we have a comment from another one of our viewers. She said, reading good literature, creative writing have been great for my guy who struggles with writing and spelling. Spelling's finally coming together at age 13. And so, yeah, like you said earlier, Julie, you know, just when they're ready. And for each of our kids, that is different. And just taking it as they can do it. So handwriting versus writing, you know, this mom was talking about.
So handwriting is learning to form the letters. That's what we emphasize for our littles. Writing is when a child puts their thoughts on paper.
Yeah.
And writing for this age is not anything more than just very, very, very simple. And this is where a lot of families, especially first and second grade, where we put too much pressure. This grade should not be writing paragraphs. They should not even be writing long sentences. They are simple, simple. They should not be worrying about grammar at this age.
Yeah.
Please don't worry about grammar. They shouldn't be having to worry about perfect handwriting. If we take their first words that they put down on that paper we start red marking it, we're going to kill their writing spirits before they even start.
So true. Yeah.
And a lot of times you don't even have a clue what they've written. That's okay. It's just a bunch of letters that mean something to them. If they can read it to you, hurrah, thumbs up, that's awesome. If they want to dictate it to you and you write it down, that's the level, that's the grade where they are.
That's great. So creative writing then waits a while, I'm assuming.
Creative writing for years to fourth to sixth graders, and that's actually where I think creative writing should start. Third, at the youngest, fourth grade, is that's when they're ready. And a lot of my fourth graders were barely, especially the boys, were barely even ready then.
Yes.
Some of them had to wait until fifth grade. Writing a paragraph for a lot of fifth grade boys is very stressful. And so when you think it in that terms, and we're trying to make our first graders write these paragraphs, please get off that. We're not on that train. They're not even close to being on that train.
So we've talked about play. We've talked about reading. What's number three?
Math. But you can interchange math and reading. Steve Demi would interchange math and reading, but I put math reading first because that's my love. I don't want to tell you what math to do. There are wonderful math programs out there. My word of advice is pick a math that fits your child's individual needs. Math should be child specific, especially children that are special learners. You pick a math that's going to
fit. We used a different one for each child. So,
and then math and regulated play go hand in hand. It begins with counting, with numbers. You're singing. You got those nursery rhymes, the reading books.
Right.
You're counting by ones. You're counting by twos, by fives, by tens, by 25s. Don't forget the 25s. My children learned all those through songs. Math includes clocks. Our littles need to learn to read both digital and analog clocks.
Right.
Teach them the analog clock. Get them a watch with the old-fashioned clock face on it. But take your time, because clocks are super, super complicated. They really are complicated. And it takes a child a long time to understand how to read them. It's not a one-time process. It takes several years for a lot of kids to grasp all the concepts of that thing that goes around and the other thing that goes around, all these little fives, tens, and 15s and all of that on that clock. So you want to start slow and simple, and you repeat. Because in math, especially, even in you're repeating everything that these kids need to learn. Math includes calendar time, graphing the weather. Don't forget to learn the days of the week and the months of the year. And back to singing we go, because that's how they learn a lot of that information.
Right. And so, you know, like teaching that calendar and weather, I think that was always a struggle for me. When do I start that?
You can start it in preschool, but don't assume that if you've done it in preschool that they've got it. You need to do it in preschool. In first and second grade, you're going to find the calendar, the weather, the clocks, all of that on every wall of every kindergarten through second grade classroom. And that you just repeat it over and over ever again. Every math fact has to be taught over and over again. Math includes shapes and sizes. You can put that on the same wall. All that can be learned during playtime. Math is in cooking. Math is in Legos. Math is in board games. Math is everywhere you look.
Right. Yeah. So what would be your biggest bit of wisdom when it comes to math?
Don't skip the first 20 lessons.
That's important. Yes.
No, so many parents think that, oh, my child already knows this. Rip,
out. Yes.
Especially when your child is in first and second grade. We think that they're too easy. My kid doesn't need this. Don't skip those. Take your time with them, because you might know them, but a lot of times your child needs to review and your child needs to feel good about themselves.
Yes.
And those first 20 lessons instill in your child a love for it and a pride for it that they need as they start getting into the lessons that are harder, especially when your child is in first and second grade, and especially second grade. Don't rip those lessons out. Do the book. If you don't finish the book, that's okay. Just make sure you start well.
Yeah, I know that is. And just the confidence in themselves and how much of a builder that is. And they can go through them quicker. And that gets them, spurs them on. You get that ball rolling. And that's when it makes everything else follow so much easier. So how much time of day really should you spend on the reading and the math when you've got a little one?
For the littlest, 10, 15 minutes max, and you're incorporating regulated play in that. For first and second graders, a little more, an hour, and you know, depend upon your child. That time, again, includes the regulated play. And again, you're incorporating into that, you're reading to them. That's part of your so on top of it, you want to read to them and you want to give them play time. If they're in second grade, a little bit more, but you know, you really, when I add up how much actual time when I was a first grade teacher, I did with my students, it was probably 45 good quality minutes of reading and about that in math. with my students. And the rest of the time you're doing fun things, play, you're going out to recess, you're doing calendar time and all that stuff. But the actual reading and the math part, you're doing probably that much. So,
yeah. Oh, that's a good reminder. Yes. So what about like other subjects like science?
Guided play. Everything should be done science with play. If you want to add it in, and you don't have to add science in, you don't have to do science at this age, but if you want to, it should be experimental play. You're learning about animals. You're learning about the body. You're learning about plants, all those things, but should all be fun, family affair, experimental, just fun.
Right. Yeah. It's that just knowledge, that base that you're building. Yep. And what do you have to say about history then?
Well, history, if you've got that 20 minutes a block of reading time, that's when you can do some history. So you can add your history in during your 20 minute of reading, which is actually cool, because that would be like a Charlotte Mason or classical approach.
Yeah.
So which is what we are. So we encourage families of kindergarten through, preschool to second grade to read, and you can read history based books. But history is for hands-on. History is one of the best hands-on activities you can do. There's so much fun hands-on stuff. I've written 4 books full of 600 plus ideas on what you can do hands-on for history. So
that's cool.
Science and history are great for doing hands-on fun, regulated play stuff.
Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that bridges right into geography as well.
Geography. Kids love doing maps. They love learning geography. They love globes. They love it. I when I taught at a Christian school, that was the favorite thing to do is geography.
There's just so many things that you can do with all of that. And is there anything else that littles can do that you want to touch on?
Cooking. Cook with them. Cooking is really fun. Don't do electronics. If I had the last piece of advice, and it would be probably at the top of my top list of advice, is electronics. These kids don't need them.
Yeah.
Preschool, kindergarten, first grade, don't use them. Just get them out of the house. Just they destroy play. They destroy brain cells. They eat up a child's desire to play. Those electronics, they rob them. Don't use electronics as a reward. Please refrain from that. A reward should be going out and playing, not you've just earned 15 minutes playing Minecraft. So that would be kind of how I would end. Just
good advice.
Play, no electronics.
Those electronics, they creep in soon enough. And if that's a habit already, I know it's super hard to break. But I hope in listening to what Julie had to say, and you did it so well, just talking about the essential part of learning through the things that we sometimes discount, or try to just, push through or set aside because we want to learn. And yet, that learning is so much happening in that unregulated play, and even through that regulated play that you were focusing on. So we just have a few minutes left, and I would love for you to talk with our audience a little bit about your resources at BiblioPlan.
So BiblioPlan is history and literature. So we are very reading based, literature based, which is why I like reading over math. We incorporate geography. We incorporate Bible. We are very, very hands-on. So everything we do, I want to try to, you are reading to your kids and you're learning history, but I want it to make it, I want the kids to experience it. So we have games, we have crafts, we have cooking. We have coloring books that the kids can color while they're listening to mom read. We have timelines they can make. We have maps that are very interactive that the kids can do. We actually now are on Zoom. So you can, and in our Zoom classes, we do crafts. I was doing 2 Zoom classes this morning, and we were doing crafts with the kids. I'm like, the kids are on one half my classes in Colorado this year. And I'm like, you guys are in Colorado and I'm in Virginia, and y'all are making this awesome Coptic cross, and they're having the most fun doing glue and all that in my class. So, so we're a smorgasbord type of curriculum. So you can pick and choose what you want to do. Mm. And for the littlest kids, my advice is to go easy, simple, 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 and make it fun. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. And so if you're listening and you can't see the screen, Julie's website is biblioplan.net. And if I'll put it in the description on our YouTube link as well. So you can just click on that after the show if you want to make it easier instead of trying to copy it off the screen and or try to spell it out as you're listening on the podcast. But yeah, you guys have some great resources, very comprehensive historic, you know, just history-based things, very hands-on, like she was talking about. And one of the reasons why we partner with you guys and recommend your curriculum, because we really are excited about the materials that you produce. They're so colorful and interactive.
Can I add one more thing real quick? I know we're almost out of time, but we do have on our website, we do have a whole section on our website on how you can adapt BiblioPlan for special needs, special learners, and also for gifted learners. So it's called Tips and Tricks, and we actually put out a little booklet that you can buy for like $6. It's really cheap. It's ebook, but it gives you all kinds of ideas on how to take our curriculum and adapt every single item that we have and make it adaptable for all ages, all grades, and all different learning styles.
Great. So, yes, I will make sure to put that link in the description as well, so that you can just click on that and go to that. That's an incredible resource. Not a whole lot of curriculum companies do that for you. So so thank you for taking the time to make that resource available to parents who are looking for options when they do have a learner that they're struggling to teach. And those are just amazing. So yeah, thank you so much. We have packed the hour and you have shared some great information. I'm just super excited to have this information now available to our audience on video and podcast. And thank you all for joining us live. I know, you know, our kids have lots of struggles. And like I said, you know, we talked about this too, Julie. It's, you know, we can have older kids and we can say, oh, I wish I would have, but, you know, start playing. Yeah. Even if they're a teenager, start playing with them. It's not too late. And if you have the little ones, you're just catching this information from Julie, and I hope you run with it instead of saying, well, you know, it kind of goes counter against what I've, you know, heard from everybody else. Well, try it. Definitely. I think the tables are turning. So thank you for bringing this to light again.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's been great. And so next week, we will be continuing this topic of early education, preschool, and we're going to be talking about the importance of learning readiness. And so we're going to be building off a lot of what Julie was talking about. And then we talked about the hierarchy of learning earlier this month. And so just, you know, making sure your kids are ready before we start pushing anything, and really we shouldn't push at all, but even start teaching, because it ends up being frustrating for us and for them. And we want to take that frustration out as much as possible by making sure kids are ready when we do start teaching, because learning should be fun and kids love to learn if we do it right. So yeah. Well, thanks so much again, Julie. And thank you all for joining us on this broadcast. It was great having you back. And I'm sure we'll have you back again. And so have a blessed week, you everybody. We are just so glad you are part of the SPED homeschool community. Just know that this broadcast was sponsored by viewers like you to make a tax-deductible donation to SPED Homeschool. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. You can visit our website at spedhomeschool.com and click the donate button. And we appreciate that. That's what keeps our ministry going, as well as our sponsors, who are organizations like BiblioPlan. And we appreciate their continued support as well. So thank you all, and have a great week, and we'll see you next week at our regular time. 12:30 Central is when we'll be broadcasting next. So we'll see you then. God bless.
These EPs find their way into the hands of Chris Tomlin. And so we got this email out of the blue that, well, he was inviting us to go on this major arena tour of the United States. And at that time we were like, well, we're not even really a band. Do we tell him we're not a band?
Chris Llewellyn from Rem Collective shares some of his life story on The Walk, a podcast for worshipers. Join us to hear conversations and devotionals from the artists of the church. Find The Walk on lifeaudio.com, worshipleader.com, or your favorite podcast platform.